You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
So here we are, Bob. We're talking on the Mining Matters podcast. You've been active in recent weeks trying to raise some money. How's the market looking to you? I believe you're pretty familiar with the market in Canada and in London. What are your takeaways about how things look at the moment?
Well, we've just come through a week or so of three back-to-back conferences in Vancouver, Alistair, and there were two investment conferences, the Metals Investor Forum and the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference, and followed by a more technical conference, the AME Roundup. And so, there were thousands of people and hundreds of companies, you know, converging on Vancouver for that week. And it was an interesting time to talk to a lot of people on both sides, from the investment side, the company side, and newsletter writers and so on. And the mood seemed to be, I would say, cautiously optimistic, which is a slightly better mood than the last couple of years. But having said that, there's still not a lot of people writing checks. The markets have picked up a bit, and as they always do, starting with senior companies going down through mid-tier producers and junior producers and so on, and gradually filtering down to the junior explorers, which are always the last ones to benefit. As far as financings go, it's still very difficult. It's because the rules here in Canada is that you have to be an accredited investor. And, how do individual companies reach out and find those accredited investors, without retail brokers, for example, and newsletter writers there are becoming fewer and fewer retail brokers out there that you can go to. And the ones that are there are sometimes reluctant to go back to their clients because we've come through, several years of really dismal markets where a lot of companies are down substantially from their highs, sometimes, 90% down and so on, particularly if they've had to do, 10-to-1 rollback or something of that nature. And so because a lot of people have lost money, they don't have any liquidity. And I had a lot of people tell me that, I love what you're doing. I think it's a great opportunity. But if I'm going to buy your company, it means I have to sell somebody else. And there's nothing else I can sell without taking a loss. And so, they don't have that liquidity. And that makes it really difficult and difficult for the retail brokers to go back to their clients, because in a lot of cases, the clients are going to say, oh, yeah, sure, you've got another one for me, just like all the others that I've lost money on. So you get that sort of dynamic going that it's still, we need to somehow find our way out of that. We need a few good wins and a few good stories or discoveries, whatever it might take to turn people's mood around a little bit. It's better, but we're not there yet.
So did you go to all three of the conferences that you mentioned then?
I went to the first two, the investment conferences. I wasn't able to stick around for the roundup because I had to change my schedule a little bit and head down to Mexico on the Tuesday. So I wasn't able to stick around for that. But yeah, I did go to the first two, and I mean they were well attended. The attendance at both of them was very good, and a lot of people eagerly listening to the newsletter writers and the pundits and the so-called experts, as to their thoughts on the markets and looking for specific company recommendations, that sort of thing. But there's still didn't seem to be as much interaction between the investors and the companies. So, the people at the booths, there was some interaction, but not as much as I'd like to see, not as much as we've seen in the past.
Because the London mining community is, as you probably know, down in South Africa at the moment for the what
Yes.
some people call the London sort of London's actual mining conference in Indaba in Cape Town. And I've heard some chatter that there may be, some certain amount of deal making opportunities on the basis of discounted valuations of assets. I mean, assets are just. The asset values are beginning to drop to such a level where maybe deals are looking reasonable to the people who might want to acquire them. And I just wonder if that kind of read sort of translates over to what you're seeing in on the Canadian side.
Yeah, we are actually starting to see some announcements. I just read two or three this morning, and we're either one company acquiring another or just project specific. So we are definitely seeing that. I think, as is often the case, when companies recognize that either the company itself or their projects are significantly undervalued, they may be reluctant to sell at those lower valuations. So there's always that hesitancy, and that can be a bit of a drag on the whole M&A scene. Sometimes it's just a matter of facing reality, and you might have to sacrifice a project or two in order to focus on your flagship, for example, and try to build it up that way. So I think we will see more of that going forward, and it's a good thing for the industry. I think there needs to be that, because one of the biggest challenges right now is that, particularly in Vancouver, there is so much competition for investors' dollars right now. As I mentioned, there were hundreds of companies represented at these conferences, and virtually everyone is out there looking for funding. So it becomes a real challenge, for everyone to try and keep their companies going. The realistically, the fewer companies we have, then the better off it's going to be for everyone, and the better, the cream rises to the top, as they say. So, hopefully that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, is there as much money in Canada as there used to be? The reason I ask is because I'm just thinking about my own experience in London, where when I started out in the mining sector, London was the mighty financial force in the world and was responsible for a huge amount of the mining financing activity that got done. But after 2008 and in subsequent years, it kind of got wiped out a bit, and it's never really come back in the same. With the same sort of power that it had back in those days. And I wonder if, is Canada is the Canada is the money in Canada as big and as powerful as it always has been? Is it on the wane, or has it gone up and down? How does the sort of institutional firepower look from your perspective?
Well, I think it has changed certainly, and it's there have we've had our ups and downs as well, there have been certain things that have happened in recent years where that have provided a lot of competition for the mining sector. Like cannabis, for example, that was a real hot commodity for a while, and then the whole cryptocurrencies. you know, which is still going. Cannabis has fallen off quite a bit, but the cryptos are still going strong, and now it's AI as well. You know, and a lot of interest there. So there are sectors like that that are drawing some of the more speculative money away from mining, and you know, unfortunately. In especially in the junior sector, you know, it's high risk, high reward, so it can be very speculative money, and you know, we sometimes refer to it as hot money, in the sense that you know, people want to get in and out, make a quick profit, and move on to the next one, and so they're looking for quick returns. They're not necessarily looking for something with a good, strong, you know, fundamental story that's still likely to be around in 2, 3, 5 years, so it's a slightly different attitude, I think. And that goes mostly to the retail sector, although, you know, that's still true to a large degree with the institutions as well. And but, you know, with the institutions, of course, they're looking at bigger deals, more established projects, better known companies, you know, that type of thing. So they're not yet looking at, you know, at the lower end of the junior explorers, which still tend to be, you know, somewhat speculative and higher risk. So, you know, we haven't seen that filter down yet. There are, I guess, several funds that have really gone belly up too, you know, over that period of time, because they just weren't getting the returns that they needed for their investors. And so they've just folded up. And even just as recently as, I think it was a couple of weeks ago now, 8 Capital in Toronto closed up shop, or announced that they were closing up.
Right.
And, you know, when you get a group like that, that was well established, well backed, just closing up due to a lack of deal flow, that really has to tell you something about the state of the industry, at least in Canada.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, from my perspective, I think that crypto and ETFs as well are basically eating the
yes.
the lunch
right.
of the junior mining sector. And I remember on a slightly different tangent, a friend of mine once told me some years ago that for the same sort of seed money or startup, you could start a pizza restaurant in London and have it cash flow positive within 9 months, whereas in a mining company it probably take 10 years. So why on earth would you invest in a mining company when you have these other
right.
options available to you? So I think there's something sort of, I mean, everybody recognizes it really these days, don't they? That there's sort of something structural in the junior mining space, at least, that's gone awry. And the real question mm-hmm. is, what can you really do about it? I mean, some people like Rick Rule and these famous names are kind of quite good at kind of consolidating such a large portfolio of companies that you know, they can rely on having a few wins. But I mean, it struck me that something you said just a moment ago, that we you know, we need a few good wins in the sector generally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, if we had some big success stories, especially in the exploration area, you know, it would make a real difference, I guess. I mean, do you think, Bob, that there are particular commodities that are going to fly with investors better than others over the, you know, the coming year or two?
I do, actually. You know, I think the way everything is trending in the world, and particularly after this weekend, you know, the start of tariff wars, you know, and trade wars, price of gold and silver, you know, has gone up, you know, quite substantially this morning, and I think that's likely to continue. I mean, there's just still so much uncertainty on the global stage on a number of different fronts, that precious metals will do well, and gold in particular is in completely uncharted territory now in terms of the price. So who knows where it could go? And you know, I think copper will do really well. simply because it's needed. It's just from a purely supply and demand standpoint, and all the trends that we're seeing with so-called green energy and the energy transition and all these buzz phrases. But copper will do well. Some of the critical minerals will do well also, but they're such tiny markets that what you often see there is that they can be more short-lived, and they'll take a real run in prices and then they'll drop back, and then some people will have great wins, other people will lose a lot of money and they'll fall out of favor. I mean, you just look at what's happened with lithium in the last few years, and before that the same sort of thing happened with cobalt. These things are sort of flavor of the month, so to speak, and so they'll come and go, and until they all sort of settle out. And the trade wars themselves could have an impact on those also, because there will be countries that do produce or have resources of certain critical minerals that are important to others. And that's something that came up this weekend, between Canada and the US. Canada talking about the nickel that we have and aluminum and other critical minerals that the US needs. President Trump's comments about how they don't need anything that Canada produces is complete nonsense. They need a lot of what we produce, so that's all going to have to sort itself out in some form or fashion. But I think nickel will probably do well over time, but there will be a lot of volatility, I think, in a lot of those markets. But I'm pretty confident in gold, silver, and copper in particular.
Yeah, and of course you've got I don't want to say how many, but let's say a great deal of experience in silver and gold, haven't you, Bob? Over the years, you've done a few companies. I remember Great Panther and Cangold, amongst others. So you've sort of really seen a few things in silver and gold. I mean, if you'd said to either of us when we first met, whenever that was, probably I'm going to say maybe it was 20 years ago. I'm not sure if that's right, but
That would be pretty close. It was 2004 that we launched Great Panther. So it would be around about that time. That was when I met Emma as well.
Yeah, amazing. So, if you'd said to either you or I, when we check back in a couple of decades time, gold is going to be at $2,700. I mean, I think in 2004, I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but it must have been at about 400 or something.
It's about right. Yeah.
And obviously the silver price moves in, give or take a few fluctuations. It sort of moves broadly in line with gold, doesn't it? So that's been correspondingly interesting too. So, do you have any kind of, have you learned anything over that that period of time about whether gold or silver is, a better or worse place to be, or any sort of reasons why you should have both? What sort of experience can you draw on now to share with us?
Yeah, I do like both, Alistair. I like exposure to both. They behave differently. Silver tends to follow almost a hockey stick pattern, where it consolidates for a period of time and then it goes almost parabolic for a very short period, but then comes back quickly, but only about halfway down to where it had consolidated previously. And then it'll consolidate on that level for a period of time, and then it'll have another bit of a parabolic run. Whereas gold tends to be a little bit more of a steady rise over time. And, there's still volatility, of course, but it doesn't necessarily follow that same sort of pattern that silver does. And so, I mean, silver, when you look at it on a daily basis, it's often quite obvious that silver does pretty much mimic gold in terms of the pattern, trading patterns and so on. If one's up, one the other one's up and down and down, similarly. But so I think from an investment standpoint and from a company standpoint, you can't it's difficult, I think, to you can't treat them both the same. You have to be aware of those trading patterns. And so if you're investing in silver, then you got to be prepared to wait a little while and then and be prepared to get in while it's consolidating. Don't wait for it to take a run and then start buying, because it goes up so quickly and then falls back so quickly that that's when you want to be selling, right? From an investment standpoint. And the companies tend to follow those patterns. So whether you're investing in bullion or just in the mining stocks, the same principles apply. So I like to have a basket of both, companies that do produce or explore for both, or developing both. And to that extent, our company Pinnacle Silver and Gold is doing exactly that. Is I mean, silver in particular usually doesn't occur on its own. It always comes with something else, and either it's gold or it's lead or zinc or even copper, and 75% of it roughly is still produced as a byproduct. So only about 25% of the world's silver actually comes from primary silver mines, and the majority of those are in Mexico. It's a different commodity in that sense, and as it sort of straddles both monetary demand or monetary patterns, and as well as industrial. And so when the economies are looking negative, and commodities like copper tend to drop, silver will often drop along with that, and it'll follow downwards, in a negative sense, following the economies down. But when things are going well, it tends to be more bullish on the monetary side of things, and will follow gold going up. So it's you have to be aware of that as well, and what takes precedent, at any particular time.
Do
So
you think
it's a little bit more complicated.
the industrial side is as important as it used to be? Because it always used to be the case that silver bulls would talk about photography as the kind of big silver consumer on the industrial side, and that's obviously changed a lot over the last couple of decades with the development of mobile phone cameras and so on. So,
Right, sure.
is it still as is the industrial side still as significant, even in spite of those technological changes?
Yeah, I think so. When you look at the demand side these days, solar panels have pretty much taken over completely, what was lost from the photography sector. And solar panels, the demand from the solar industry is continuing to grow. So I think that demand will continue. So the photography side of things really has been completely replaced and doesn't even enter the equation anymore. So I think that on the demand side, that will continue. Electronics certainly is continuing to grow, and especially with electrification and everything, so that there will be more demand there going forward. So I think the demand side for silver is still going to be very strong. So I think it's still a very good argument that's going to be the basic foundation for silver demand. But ultimately, what drives the price is investment. It's the investment community that drives the price in silver. It really always has been. It's such a tiny market that it really doesn't take very much to move the silver price. And it's yeah, I mean that's really what controls it. It's not a supply demand equation the same way as it would be for copper or nickel. It's quite different in that regard.
Do you get any tax breaks in Canada for holding silver dollars? In the same way in the UK, you can get tax breaks on gold coins. But if you buy, for example, if you buy an American silver dollar in the UK, that's taxable in terms of the of capital gains if the silver price rises. But if it's a coin of the realm in the UK, then it isn't a taxable capital gains. Have you got anything equivalent like that in Canada?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't really dabble much in the coin market, so I'm certainly no expert when it comes to that. But I don't recall having heard anything. I don't think either one of them are taxable. But neither are there any breaks. I don't think for holding them. So it's I think it's a bit of a non-issue here, really.
So you mentioned Pinnacle a moment ago. I mean, I should say that you've had, as I mentioned, a lot of experience in gold and silver, and you've been hands-on in Mexico with Great Panther, where you had Guanajuato, I remember, and one of the most interesting mines that you had. So what's the story now? What are you up to? You've done these companies that we've mentioned. Now you've got Pinnacle, but a lot of our audience might not be aware of Pinnacle. So tell us a little bit about that.
So what we're looking at right now is an acquisition of a project, a gold silver project that is actually very close to the Topia mine, which was the very first silver mine that we acquired with Great Panther. And the business model that we had with Great Panther right from the beginning was to acquire a past producing mine, get it back into production as quickly as possible, and then try to grow the company out of cash flow more than relying on the markets all the time. And I think with Great Panther, we were successful in doing that because after 13 years of running the company, we only had about 165 million shares on issue. And we had peaked at about a 600 million market cap and $5 share price. So, and with three operating mines, because we acquired Topia when it was not operating, and then spent 2 years drilling off a resource and refurbishing the plant and getting it back into production. And during that 2 year period was when we were able to acquire the Guanajuato mine, and then we did the same sort of thing there. And so, one just gives you the opportunity to acquire another one and to continue to grow the company and so on. And so we're looking at trying to do the same sort of thing with Pinnacle. And as I say, it's very close. It's actually only 13 kilometers as the crow flies from the Topia mine. And we have three other operating mines in the nearby area within the district. Luca Mining is just to the northwest. The Cienega mine owned by Fresnillo is just to the southeast. And then there's another one that's privately operated. So, we have four operating mines within 35 kilometers. So it's a very, very prolific district. And yet, despite all of that, this particular project has been privately owned for 40 years and has never been explored by modern methods. So it's never been drilled, despite the fact that there are historic artisanal scale mines on the property. There was a 100 ton per day plant built there in 1989-90 that operated for a short period of time. And the historic grade that was reported, and I have to qualify that by saying that this there are no established records, no assay sheets or anything like that to really back this up. But what we've been told and the information provided by the vendor was that the average grade was about 10 grams per ton gold equivalent. So it's about 75% gold and 25% silver, no base metals. So very, very good grade underground mines, and the old mines extend over a length of about 500 meters along strike. But without any drilling, there's really nothing to go on as far as you know how big, how extensive this whole system might be, you know, despite what we can see underground. And so, you know, our geological assessment is that this is quite a strong system, being where it is within this well endowed district is a terrific indicator as well. And you know, extending over 500 meters plus, it's got some strength to it. So, you know, we're very optimistic that we can get in there and start doing some modern exploration, you know, mapping, sampling underground, and then drilling to develop a resource. And during that time, we plan to get the plant back up and running again. And if we can do that within a short period of time, which we think we can, then, you know, we can put that back into production, albeit on a small scale initially. But the way we've structured the deal is that once we do go back into production, that automatically earns us 50% interest. And so from that point going forward, we're entitled to 50% of the proceeds. And then we can use that to continue to develop the property to its ultimate potential, as well as making the payments to get us to the point where we have a 90% interest. And then the vendor will have the option of either, you know, keeping a 10% participating interest or converting that to a 2% NSR, which, you know, we think that's the more likely case. But that would give us 100% interest, you know, just 2 years after starting production. And then we can continue to build the project out. And, you know, whatever opportunities come along in the interim, obviously we'll be looking at, you know, continue to grow the company there as well, just as we did with Great Panther. So a very, very similar business model. And I think we've got a great place to start. And you know, 100 tons per day might sound small to some, but, you know, we had the same criticism when we acquired the Topia mine as well. People said, oh, it's small, it's this, it's that. But it's just a stepping stone. You know, it's just, you know, it's what we need to try and avoid, you know, these markets that we find ourselves in right now, where so many companies trading at low valuations and having to do dilutive financings just to survive. So if we can bypass that and, you know, use money that we're generating from cash flow, then we'll be that much better off.
So, yeah, I mean, you talk about rehabilitating the plant, and I assume you're also referring to getting the old workings there up and running and putting material from yes. that project through that plant.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's walking distance. It's a few hundred meters from the mines to the plant. And, you know, the plant sits on private property. That's we're just working out the details of that, but that's, you know, effectively controlled by the vendor. So, you know, there are no surface rights issues. You know, the plant, we think that it can be, refurbished and back up and running, you know, for somewhere in the $1 to $2 million range. So, you know, we're not talking tens of millions or anything like that to get the plant going again. You know, the infrastructure is there, the conveyors, the ball mills. It'll need new crushers, new pumps, new electrical, you know, that sort of thing. But you know, we think we can do all of that and in a relatively short period of time. And because the plant is already there, you know, this is a disturbed site already. So from a permitting standpoint, we're not going into, you know, sort of virgin territory where we're going to have to do this massive environmental studies and so on. You know, there are already roads in there, and there's an area for the camp and offices and so on. So, you know, we can just rehabilitate all of that. And I think the ability to permit that will be, you know, that much faster and easier than it would be if it was just out in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, we do have road access. There's a power line within 3 kilometers of the plant. So we'll be looking to extend that down so that we can run off of grid power rather than, you know, diesel, which would be, you know, that much more expensive. And so, you know, I think and being in a mining district, we will have access to some, you know, skilled labor as well. So, you know, as we gradually build this up, yeah, we have pretty much everything that we need within a couple of hours. You know, Topi has an airstrip. You can fly in there. You can drive in from Durango. You know, as far as infrastructure goes, it's great.
So what kind of resource do you think you've got then? I mean, do you have any historic numbers, or is it just based on the historic production figures? What can you sort of tell us about that?
Well, there is a historic resource, but you know, as I mentioned before, I do have to, you know, qualify that by saying that it is a historic resource, and you know, we haven't really done any work ourselves to validate that, to verify it. But you know, the numbers that were provided to us, and this is based on underground sampling and old production records, which we don't have, but our sampling that we have done as part of our due diligence has pretty much validated the grades, at least. But the, you know, historical resources, it's small. It's, you know, it's only on the order of 45,000 and a half tons at about 10 grams per ton gold equivalent. Or 869 grams per ton silver equivalent, depending on how you look at it. So it's, you know, it's very good grade. But you know, if we're thinking that if we can delineate enough to kick this off at somewhere around 100 tons per day, then at that grade and the recoveries that we would anticipate from that type of a process, then you know, we should be generating somewhere between 11,000 and 12,000 ounces gold equivalent a year. And, you know, we'll have immediate access to 50% of that, and then going to 70 and then to 90 over the next couple of years. So, you know, with these, with metal prices being where they are, you know, we think that, you know, we can do that profitably. And then, as I say, continue to, you know, use that cash flow to build the company. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see whether we would go the route of you know, an actual economic study like a PEA or pre-feas or anything. I think for that scale of production, it's unlikely. You know, I think just based on our own experience with these types of operations, that we should be able to commence production without doing that. But of course, without a PEA, at a minimum, we're not actually going to be able to publish a compliant resource. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. We will be able to publish the resource. We won't be able to talk about economics. So, you know, in terms of talking about, you know, how much cash flow we might be generating or what our cost per ounce is going to be, or, you know, those types of things. So, you know, we might be a little restricted in the early days, but, you know, I think from experience, you know, we should be able to get this up and running within, I'd say, 2 to 3 years.
Are the old workings extensive, or was it quite a small scale in the previous incarnation?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're extensive. There are three separate mines along that 500 meter strike, and you can access all of them. You know, you can walk right in. There are a couple of spots where, you know, you'd have to be careful. And the first thing we want to do in rehabilitating those is to get some guys in there to scale them properly and make them safe, you know, for our guys to go in and then actually start doing some systematic sampling. So, you know, we're going to operate, you know, at the highest standards of safety as far as that goes. I think there's probably somewhere in the nature of maybe 500 meters in total of underground workings. you know, combination of drifts and crosscuts and stopes, that sort of thing. But you know, there's mining equipment in the area and the district and skilled labor. So you know, I think we'll be able to get back in there and start working on that fairly quickly.
Is there anything interesting to be said about the geology that that the layman can comprehend?
I think the key things really are the grade, that's very good, and the fact that it's only gold and silver. I mean, there are no base metals in this system from what we've seen, and you know, so that typically would increase the recoveries of gold and silver, and reduce the processing costs. And there doesn't seem to be any deleterious elements from what we've seen so far, you know, as far as, you know, anything like mercury or antimony or arsenic or, you know, anything of that nature. So, you know, we can just have a dry stack tailings facility next to the plant. And so, I mean, from an environmental standpoint, it'll be a very small footprint. And being underground and a small operation, and that in turn will it will increase the our ability to, or improve our ability to permit this, I think, fairly quickly.
So I guess this is a vein project, is it?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So so really, what you're doing is going after these veins and hoping that you know, that there's quite a lot left beyond the 500 meters that have already been worked.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the veins do show good strength and, you know, reasonable widths. You know, the thing about going back into underground workings is that you can really only see what's been opened up in the past, so you have no idea what lies beyond the walls or the roof of the opening. So you know, it's a little hard to extrapolate, you know, but you can look at the intensity of the structure and the alteration and the brecciation and, you know, things like that, geological features that give you some indication of the strength of the system, and the fact that, you know, these are on a northwest southeast trend, which is the regional trend for the entire Sierra Madre gold silver belt that extends, you know, up into northwestern Mexico and even on up into California, and then, you know, down into the lower part of Mexico as well. And it's on strike with the Cienega gold mine, you know, or polymetallic mine that's owned by Fresnillo. And you know, that's a 4,000 ton per day operation underground, one of the largest underground mines in Mexico, and we're on trend with that. So you know, I think, you know, that too really lends itself to some confidence, I guess, that, you know, this is we're part of a very strong system here, and the fact that the old underground workings just haven't extended any farther, you know, as I said, it was operated just on an artisanal basis by some locals for a number of years, and then a mining contractor who built the plant operated it for less than 2 years before it was actually the government that shut everything down. So you know, it hasn't operated since 1990. There's been nothing done there. No, you know, no drilling, no modern exploration of any kind. So we're quite confident that we can go in there and really start to get a better understanding of what's there and prove up the potential of the project.
So why was it shut down?
Well, our understanding is that there was some issue over unpaid taxes or something. Okay. I didn't ask too many questions.
Right.
That was my understanding. It was resolved in the end, the owner got everything back. And, you know, we have checked that out, you know, legally, and everything's, you know, from a legal standpoint, everything's in good shape now. That's, you know, was my understanding why it was closed some 35 years ago.
Yeah, right. So it wasn't because the grades had declined or the commodity prices had
No, it
tanked or
wasn't.
anything
It
like
was,
that.
you know, it wasn't for any technical reason at all. In fact, the fellow that operated it then, he's the one that built the plant. He's the one that's selling it to us now. He's a mining contractor,
All
and
right, okay.
so I mean, he knows the business, and he has been wanting to get this back into production ever since. But in that interim, he developed and built another polymetallic silver lead zinc mine that's only about 25 kilometers from Potrero, and he's operating that now. It's privately owned, and he just didn't have the financial capacity to do both, so that's why he was looking for a partner to bring this one back on stream. And unlike a lot of juniors that just would just want to go in and spend a money bunch of money on drilling, drill off a big resource, and then decide how to proceed from there. He was so keen on getting it back into production, and he knows the potential of the project, that he wanted to partner with someone who was like-minded in terms of getting it back into production as quickly as possible. And that's kind of, where we came along, and that's exactly what we'd like to do as well. So we're very much like-minded in that respect, and that's why we were able to do a deal where other companies weren't, because he just wasn't interested in just drilling off a resource.
Yeah, so I mean, did you find, perhaps it's a bit of an obvious question, but I mean your experience in Mexico, and you mentioned that Topia is only a matter of a few kilometers away. Did that sort of swing the deal, as it were? Did this chap that you're talking about go, well, okay, these guys know a thing or two about how to get things done in this part of the world?
Yeah, no, it totally did, Alistair. He liked the fact that not only were we familiar with the area, but the reputation that we have in that area. It's and for me personally, it was quite rewarding, because we flew into Topia fairly recently, and that little town was just bustling. When I first went in there with my business partner at the time, who was Francisco Ramos, who was a Mexican mining engineer, and we drove in 2003, and it was a sleepy little town, just subsistence farming, and maybe 3,000 people, and not much going on. The mine had closed several years prior to that, and there was nothing. There was no industry or anything. And by bringing that mine back on stream, and all of the jobs, the benefits to the local economy, which then spill over, they say it's like a 7-to-1 job generation from the resource industry. So new restaurants, suppliers, and services, and so on and so forth. That the Topia municipality now is over 9,000 people, so it's roughly tripled in size. And that's really because we brought that mine back on stream. So, to go back in there now and see all of that, and recognize, that the part that we played in doing that was extremely rewarding. And, there's still a small, I'm not sure what you would call it even. This little structure in the main square, in front of the city hall, that Great Panther built effectively, or paid for, that the mayor at the time, wanted to put up, to sort of recognize the contribution that the company had made to the town, as well as herself, of course. And so that's still there, and it has the Great Panther name and everything. And so, I mean, everyone in town knows who Great Panther is, and the company, despite the fact that it's no longer around, still has a great reputation in Topia. And for us to go back in there, we can sit in a restaurant and talk with the locals, at the table next to us, and we're perfectly accepted there. And so I think, knowing that, that we are accepted that way, you know, for the vendor of the Potrero project to know that, you know, we're comfortable working in that area, and the locals are comfortable with us. That was a huge plus, you know, and really I think helped to seal the deals, you know, from our perspective.
Yeah, right. So is the Topia mine itself still going?
Yes, it is. It's owned by Guanajuato Silver, and you know, it's running at about 250 tons a day, I believe. And you know, that mine was brought into production by what was then Peñoles, you know, that owns Fresnillo, in 1954, roughly. They built the road in 1952, I believe, and you know, they had it in production from 54 through to 89, and then sold it to a private individual who operated it for 10 years, shut it down in 99. We bought it in 2004, had it back in production in 2006, and it's been operating ever since. So, you know, aside from that 99 to 2006 period, that 7 years, this mine has operated continuously from 1954 through to present day for 70 years.
Amazing.
And so it's quite remarkable, especially, you know, given the size, but it's a very prolific district with very high grades. And, you know, I often think back to the days of the great financial crisis where everyone was struggling. And in 2009, it was the Topia mine that really helped to save Great Panther, because the average silver grade produced in 2009 was 500 grams per ton. That's not a silver equivalent. That's just silver. Mm. And we had lead and zinc on top of that and a bit of gold. You know, so as metal prices came back, you know, after the crisis, it was the Topia mine that that really helped to save the company and take us on to bigger and better things. And that district, just one last little anecdote, that district is one of the oldest mining districts in Mexico, dating back to the year 1538, wow. When it was, you know, discovered by the Spaniards, and the first mining concessions granted around the year 1600. So, you know, it has an amazing history and very, very prolific over those years. So I'm just really excited to be back in there with a great project. And, you know, I think it has super potential.
Yeah. So, so who's running Guanajuato Silver then? Do you talk to those guys now? Is that, do you?
I do. Yes. It's a Vancouver based company. James Anderson is the CEO, and, we talk periodically and, keep in touch. You know, they bought all of Great Panther's Mexican assets, just prior, the year prior to Great Panther, unfortunately going bankrupt, due to their, acquisition of the, mine in Brazil, but that's another story.
Which was kind of after you'd left, so, really, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
Which was kind of after you'd left that all happened.
Yes, yeah, no, it was. I stepped down in 2017, and they acquired that mine in 2019.
Yeah.
And then it just dragged them down, and they went under 2022.
Yeah. So just before we perhaps begin to wrap things up, Bob, because we've been talking for a little while and very enjoyable it's been too, but you've mentioned a couple of times the transaction that Pinnacle is doing, but we haven't really gone into the sort of nuts and bolts of it. So what actually are you up to? You've been talking to these investors at these conferences. What's the what does it look like, and what can you tell us about how it's going to proceed?
Well, the deal itself, we structured this as what we call a staged option. And, you know, a standard option agreement for an exploration company is that, you know, it would be spread out over maybe 3 to 5 years. And, you know, you make some smaller payments in the first few years, do a bunch of work. And then you finally get to a point, you know, at the end of the term, where maybe you make a blowout payment, and that's when you acquire 100%. But up until that point, you really have nothing. You know, so if you walk away at any point during that period, you really have nothing to show for all the money that you've spent. And I mean, it's one thing if you don't find what you're looking for and you're justified in walking away, but sometimes markets and other things kind of force you into that situation where you basically just have to walk away and don't have a choice. With this particular deal, because we wanted to get into production quickly, there's no point in being in production if you don't have access to the cash flow. And there's no point in paying for it up front if you're not going to benefit from it. So we structured it such that it will initially make some payments. So it's $50,000 on and 500,000 shares on signing the agreement, which I'm hoping should be another week or so, maybe two. And then 8 months later, there's $200,000 and 1 million shares. And then a year after signing the agreement, 750,000 and 1 million shares. So really just $1 million in that first year and 2.5 million shares. These are US dollars. And then as we think we can get it back in production in about 2 years, when we start production at that point, we would make another $1 million payment, 1 million shares. But that would give us a 50% interest. And so from that point going forward, we would be entitled to 50% of the proceeds of the project. And then a year after that, we would make another $1 million payment. And that would get us an extra 20%, taking us to 70. And then again, another year after that, so 2 years after starting production, we would make a final payment of about $3 million. But again, another 20% at that point, taking us to 90%. And that's where the vendors can either stay at that participating 10% interest or convert that to a 2% NSR, which would basically give us 100% interest at that point in time. And so, it's important to point out that once we start production, all of the payments from that point forward should be able to make those out of cash flow. So really the only things that we have to finance out of equity initially is that first year's $1 million. That's about it really.
So what's the significance? So I think you said initial payment of 50,000 US dollars, and then after 8 months, is that right? Did you say 8 months?
Yeah, that's correct.
What's the significance of 8 months as opposed to 12 or 9 or any other number?
It's, it's an interesting question, Alistair. The stock exchange here, the venture exchange, has determined that the nature of this acquisition is what they call a fundamental acquisition.
Right.
And it's not a full-blown RTO. It's a little bit less onerous than that, I guess you could say. But part of that is that we have to show through the financing, we have to show that we will have enough working capital for a 6 month period, which would include any payments to the vendor and work program that's recommended in the 43-101 technical report that we had to provide to the exchange, which we have done, and they've approved that subject to finalizing the agreement and so on. So because of that 6 month condition, we structured the deal such that the next payment was due after that 6 month, so that payment does not fall within that 6 month requirement. It gives us a little bit extra time to raise that extra money to make that payment. Recognizing that the markets are difficult, we didn't want to have to raise that money up front right now at our current share price, which is halted at 4 cents. And hopefully by the time we get to that point, that we can do another raise at better prices, and it'll be less dilutive and better for shareholders. So that's really what it came down to. It was just the timing issue was related to that 6-month requirement.
Yeah, right. So that'll be like in September time, or possibly October, I suppose. And the world may look very different then.
Right. Yeah. Who knows where we would be at? But it gives us basically that time to do another financing, which we'll need to do in order to conduct a drilling program. Anyways, the money that we're raising right now is for those initial payments and the initial work that we need to do, to rehabilitate the underground workings, clean up the plant area, get started on mapping and sampling, that sort of thing. And then, we'll raise some more money for the drill program.
So how much are you hoping to raise initially?
Well, we've announced 800,000 Canadian. And that's that's still what we're targeting. It is still open, and we won't have to close that off until basically the exchange has signed off on all the other documents that we have to provide, like the agreement. And so they've already approved the technical report and the title opinion as well. So we're just waiting on that draft of the definitive agreement to submit to them for review. So within the next week to 10 days, we'll be looking at closing off the financing. But 800,000 is the target at the moment.
Have you got any interesting cornerstones, or is it just the usual friends and family and a few other?
I guess I could say yes, although I probably shouldn't say too much about who it is, but we have brought in a couple of strategic investors from Mexico, actually. I will say that much. And so we're not talking about standards, institutions or anything like that. This is still pretty early stage for, to be an institutional story.
Yeah.
But we are talking to some people in Mexico, and I'm already looking forward to what the next potential deal could be. I'm not kidding when I talk about trying to grow the company, trying to build the company. I'm quite serious about that. So this really is, I think, a ground floor opportunity. If we can develop this in the same way that we managed to develop Great Panther. I mean, our first financing with Great Panther when we launched was 35 cents, and ultimately we took it to $5. So starting here now at 4 cents, who knows where we go from here.
Yeah, and then especially since gold and silver prices are just roaring away, aren't they? So you've got real
they really are
power, yeah, power behind you there.
There's a huge disconnect between the metal prices and the share prices of the mining companies. It's just, I don't think it's ever been like this before. You look at any graph comparing, the prices to, whether you use the Huey or any of these indexes, GDXJ, anything like that. And it's just, the divergence is just absolutely amazing. But sooner or later, that's going to have to correct. And when it does, boy, we'll be in for quite a ride. So I think for anyone who believes in that, believes in the industry, this is a great time to be investing in these kinds of companies, these kinds of opportunities.
Yeah, it's really hard to know what sort of metaphor to kind of throw into a conversation about this subject. But I mean, if it was sort of stretched elastic between the commodities prices, mm-hmm. gold and silver, and the equities prices, the elastic would be so wide that you imagine the rebound is just going to be immense, right. Powerful and fast.
Yeah.
Who knows if that's an accurate assessment or a good way of looking at it, but it certainly is, crossed my mind that, if there's a tipping point. It could just be spectacular and very, very fast, possibly. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think, and going back to what I was saying earlier, it likely will be for silver because that's the way silver typically trades anyways. Gold will show this continual steady rise the way it's been doing. And to that extent, investors have the opportunity to play this according to the level of risk that they're comfortable with. So, as things, do come back, and I hope it's not quite as severe as your elastic analogy, because it would knock us all for a loop. But if it comes back a little bit more gradually at first, before it has that final rocket ship approach, then it will give people an opportunity to still get out at a good profit, along the way. And it will be a very good opportunity, I think, because we do seem to have come up off the bottom, but we're not that much off the bottom at the moment. And this is still a terrific time, I think, to be getting in.
Yeah, right. So you've clearly not had enough of the mining sector yourself, Bob. You're talking, just a minute ago about building, cutting more deals, building a new company. You yourself are not running out of steam by the sounds of it.
No, I don't feel like I am. I did go through a period after I stepped down from Great Panther. I did go through a period where, I wasn't quite sure where things were going to go, and I kind of got more back on the exploration side of things because that, going back to my roots, I guess you could say, as an exploration geologist. But it's been such a tough slog, in the markets these last few years that I ultimately came back to the same frame of mind I was in the early 2000s, coming out of the whole dot-com period where, from, say, post-BREX, in the sort of 98 time frame through to 2001, maybe even 2002, it was almost impossible to raise any money in the mining sector. And then, in that 2001, 2002 timeframe is when we really started to see gold start to tick up a little bit. And then 2003 is when silver joined the party. And that was when we came up with this concept of getting into production and building the company out of cash flow, just rather than staying in pure exploration and relying on the markets. So, having done that and done that successfully, and looking at some of our peers, I mean, Endeavour Silver started at exactly the same time we did, First Majestic started the year before with the same sort of business model. Fortuna Silver, we were all doing the same sort of thing, and it's a model that worked and continues to work. So, I just kind of found myself back in that same sort of headspace, thinking, okay, this is ridiculous. I can just keep beating my head against the wall, trying to fund exploration, or I can go back to, a successful business model and just try to do it again. So here we are.
Yeah, because you had that Nevada exploration company for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, well, that's actually the same company. I mean, we've changed the name. It used to be New Range Gold, but that's exactly the sort of thing that I'm talking about. I got involved in that as a director in 2018, when they already had the project in Nevada. And as much as I liked it geologically, it was one of those all or nothing type deals, where, we were making cash payments to the vendor every year. We had to pay the mining taxes to the BLM every year. There was our ongoing cost of exploration and so on and so on. But then when it became hard to fund things, we really had no choice but to drop it because we just couldn't afford to continue. We couldn't afford to make those payments. You couldn't fund that. And so we had to walk away with absolutely nothing, which is the unfortunate side of that type of an option agreement. So that's where we've effectively come back to this kind of a stage staged option where we do actually have something, once we put this mine in production, even on a small scale, and then that gives us the opportunity to build it out from there.
Yeah, it was quite a peer group that you mentioned a moment ago, Fortuna and First Majestic. I mean, those are some big, pretty impressive names,
Well, absolutely. If it wasn't for that failed acquisition in Brazil, Great Panther potentially could have followed that same trajectory. But that's life, and I don't,
Well, you're coming back round now, Bob, so we'll see what comes of this this one. Okay, so do you think that we've sort of covered Pinnacle pretty well? Is there anything else you reckon the world might be interested in knowing?
The only thing I might mention, Alistair, is that before we acquired this project in Mexico, Pinnacle did have a couple of projects in the Red Lake area of northwestern Ontario.
Okay.
And one of those is also a past producing mine, very high grade, almost 13 grams per ton gold, and it produced up until 1952 when it was shut down, and it produced about 100,000 ounces of gold, and that's the Argosy gold mine. And it was only mined to a depth of 270 meters. And, in that part of the world, in the Canadian Shield, and the biggest dimension on these deposits is vertical. And, they often go for kilometers to depth. And, we know from previous work on the property that the mineralization does indeed continue below the old workings. And, at some point, we'd love to get back in there and continue that work and demonstrate the potential of that project as well. And right next door to it, we have our North Birch project, which is much earlier stage, admittedly, but it has an 8 kilometer long target that we only managed to get one hole into it, but it's showing, all the signs of a good, strong structural system, lots of alteration, sulfide mineralization, only weak gold values in the first hole, but they are there. And so we'd love to get back in and try to drill that off some more and follow that out. So, there's great potential in that part of the part of the country, I guess you could say, as well. And that aspect of the company, it's only 10 kilometers from the Springpole deposit that's being developed by First Mining Gold. And that's roughly 5 million ounces, and not very far away. So again, coming back to that concept of, the best place to find a mine is in the shadow of a headframe. And even though, Springpole will be an open pit as opposed to underground, Argosy is underground, but it's only 10 kilometers away. So you're in a quite a prolific district, and so it's, that's got a lot of potential as well. But it's been very difficult to raise any money on something like that. It's just it's been very difficult, and just because of the permitting process in Canada, taking longer, and it's unlikely that we would be able to move Argosy forward to production as quickly as we could with Potrero in Mexico. So that's really why we've chosen to go this route and, focus on this project in Mexico. And if we can get that up and running and generating some cash flow, then, hopefully we can spend some of that off to work on the Red Lake projects as well.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation, isn't it? Permitting in Canada.
Yes, indeed.
does it cost you anything to maintain the licenses?
No, it doesn't. The Argosy mine is patented and it's owned 100%. So, we just have a very small amount of taxes to pay on that each year. And with North Birch, again, we own 100% of that. And it's just, we just have to file the assessment credits, which we have enough to cover us for the next 7 or 8 years, I think. So really there are no appreciable holding costs on either of those projects.
So you've got a pretty good team at Pinnacle as well, I think, Bob. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have a lot of depth on our board, Alistair. In addition to having a couple of guys in Vancouver that look after the whole financial side of the company, they're very strong at that. We have two individuals in particular that make a significant contribution to, to what we're doing. David Solari has been with the company for quite a long time, and he's a metallurgical engineer based in Toronto. He has his own consulting firm there and is actually building two plants in Mexico at the moment. I probably shouldn't mention the name of the companies that he's doing that for, but so David is certainly well versed in building plants, and particularly in Mexico, where he's familiar with the whole working environment. And so when it comes time to getting this plant back up and running at Potrero, Dave's certainly has the expertise to be able to do that and oversee that project. So it's great to have that knowledge in-house. And the other fellow that I really enjoy working with is Colin Jones. And Colin is a New Zealand geologist that has a tremendous reputation worldwide, actually. He's a partner in a Perth-based fund. But in addition to that, Colin has traveled the world looking at a variety of different deposits, and in a previous life, I guess you could say, he was the lead investigator for Freeport-McMoRan when they uncovered the scam at BRIAX in Indonesia.
Right, okay.
And so, Colin was actually in the Jakarta airport waiting for that fateful helicopter to arrive,
Wow, okay. Wow.
without one particular passenger that apparently got off somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Collins has, is a great geologist. It's a lot of respect around the world, and from myself as well. And I really enjoy working with Colin, on these types of projects. And I took him down there in December, and he likes the opportunity here as well. So, it's great to have that kind of depth on the board. And when it comes time to putting this all together and building up not just the project but the company, I think we're very well positioned to do that.
Yeah, sounds like you're in good shape. Well, I guess we'd better wrap it up there, Bob. I one thing I want to ask you before we go our separate ways, you to the rest of your morning and me to my evening. Did you sort of approach have you approached any London money for Pinnacle? I mean, because you used to be, or you probably still are, very well networked into London. Are there going to be any UK investors in this round?
I don't believe so, not in this particular round. I haven't, to be honest, done much marketing in London in recent years, and that's something that I do want to start again, because you're right. We did have quite an extensive network there, and over in mainland Europe as well. And interestingly, aside from the Mexican investors that I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of the rest of the money coming in on this round has come from mainland Europe. It has not come from Canada or US. So that does also tell you something about the state of the markets over here, that it has been extremely difficult to raise any money in Canada or the US. The funding has come from Europe and Mexico.
So when you say Europe, do you mean like Frankfurt and Switzerland, or is it
Nope.
no, okay.
No, actually, and that's one of the funny things, that it has not come from the traditional areas that one might think of, and where we used to raise money in the past. No, this is coming from Eastern Europe,
Wow, okay, interesting.
from Hungary, Slovenia, Croatia, Germany to some degree, places like that. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I mean, perhaps we can get a bit more into that next time you and I sit down and have a chat, and we can sort of work out what's driving that dynamic, because I haven't heard of that before. But that's very interesting. Well, Bobby, it's been really good to talk to you. Thanks very much, and good luck with the raise.
Likewise, Alistair. Yeah, no, likewise. I appreciate the opportunity. It's great to chat again, and hopefully the next time we do this, it'll be in person, in London, and looking forward to that even more.
Yeah, great.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.